there's no way to record how Florida's delegation in the House of Representatives voted on the ouster of their colleague, Liz Cheney. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, what the ouster of Liz Cheney means for her political future and the GOP as we look at Florida politics around this, too. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, why hemp is becoming Florida's biggest cash crop, at least according to some financial experts, and how you can get some one-of-a-kind Jaguars merchandise, courtesy of the Cultural Council. That and more all ahead. First, though, here's your COVID update for the day. A statewide increase yesterday of 3,184 cases of the virus and 51 additional deaths. So keep getting those vaccines, everyone. All right, our big story of the day, House Republicans removed Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming Wednesday as their conference chair in retaliation for her continued criticism of former president and now Florida resident Donald Trump and his continued lies about a stolen election, along with his role in the January 6th riot and insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. We're going to discuss this in the context of the Florida delegation to the House of Representatives. There's no way to know how most of these members voted, although it's fair to assume the majority of them, if not all of them, voted by voice to boot Cheney from leadership. Jacksonville Congressman John Rutherford gave a radio interview yesterday where he explained his rationale behind voting to oust Cheney. We discuss all this with Sean Frieder now. He teaches political science at UNF, and he's on the line. Hey, Sean, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And let us know your thoughts about this, everyone. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Let's begin, Sean, by pointing out that Republicans ousted Cheney from leadership because she insisted on telling the truth, that the election was not stolen and that the president actively fomented a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
Absolutely. She's been ousted, or she's been attempted to be ousted a few months ago back in February. So she's being punished for a combination of being willing to stand against Trump's position on the election, but also for continuing to talk about it. And I think that's sort of why we're seeing this vote come back up again, is, you know, that the House conference members have known her position on this for a while. But she's continued to speak about it. And I think that since February, when they first had their original vote on this, which she survived, that she would stop speaking about this. But she's continued to talk about this. And that's, I think, what's led to this vote.
It was a voice vote. So there's no way to know how your representative voted for the most part here in Florida, although Congressman John Rutherford has gone on record saying he supported it. When he gave an interview yesterday, Sean, he never mentioned former President Trump or the insurrection at the Capitol. He, however, though, multiple times said that the leader of their conference needs to be focused on fighting the White House's, in his words, socialist agenda. And he used that term three or four times, socialist agenda. You know what? It struck me as ironic clearly that there was coordinated messaging on the part of Representative Rutherford and other Republicans to continually hammer on this idea of a socialist agenda by Democrats, given that the job that Liz Cheney had as the number three is to line up messaging. That's what her position does. You get everyone in a room and you tell them, this is the message we're going to be putting out. And so now it looks as though they're going to bring in another congresswoman from New York, possibly to take over, Elise Stefanik, who had a much less conservative voting record, we need to point out, than Liz Cheney, to get everybody on the same page, driving messaging like socialist agenda to media outlets, even though Elise Stefanik is until very recently anyway, was far less conservative than Liz Cheney.
That's right. Between the two of them, if you're looking simply at voting record, Cheney and for a long time has had the more conservative record of the two. Elise Stefanik has actually voted against Trump on a number of positions, including national security, climate change, a couple of other things. Basically, she's trying to position herself as sort of a youth voice within the party. She got elected at a very young age. And I think the party is trying to solve the problem of, what votes do they go after from this point forward? Talking constantly about Trump as a liability, particularly talking about him in a negative sense, which is, going to alienate both prospective members of the party, independents, as well as people in the base, which is, something that Cheney was doing too much of for their taste. And as you said, the House Conference Chair is largely, it's a messaging position, and to a certain extent, it's almost like a union rep position. She's sort of representing the rank and file members of the House Republican Caucus to the leadership as well. So from a purely functional position, this is not too surprising that we see this happening. She is representing an unpopular, at the very least controversial, position within her own party. She's supposed to be within the leadership and being on board with the messaging and trying to direct the messaging against Democrats rather than towards Republicans. And she's simply violating commandment numbers 1 through 10 of party politics, which is don't split the vote within your own party. And that's something that she's been doing. So the interesting thing about this is not that she's been voted out. She's done many things that probably would result in someone being voted out. What's interesting in this is the substantive reason for which she's being voted out, which is that she's willing to talk about President Trump's lies about the election.
Right. And continues to point out that those that don't acknowledge the big lie about the election are, in her words, at war with the Constitution. Now, as this happened with Rep. Cheney this week, Sean, at the same time, there is another groundswell happening, a group of Republicans saying that they are looking to perhaps form a third party. These are moderate Republicans, what they call a common sense coalition, asking those that feel the way they do, who are moderate to pragmatic conservatives, to split off from the GOP and form a third party, since they perceive that the GOP as it's constituted today has become radicalized and is in fealty to a former president who continues to insist on lies about the 2020 election. What are your thoughts about this movement? It's certainly a minority of Republicans who are part of that coalition.
Sure. They are they're trying to figure out a way to wrest back control of their party, certainly feeling that even though he's not in any formal office right now, Trump is sort of a king in exile position within the party and still is able to have tremendous control over their fundraising, their messaging, and trying to find any way they can to get out from under that thumb. Now, in terms of the prospects of that, mounting third-party campaigns, especially ones in which you try to get membership to abandon their current major party for a third party that really has no infrastructure, funding, support, network, et cetera, that's a tall order. That's a very, very difficult climb to make. This is something that almost certainly would not be successful. Abandoning the Democratic or Republican Party is very the structural advantages, the deep structural advantages those parties offer. So they probably won't be successful, almost certainly will not be successful in that drive. It's not even clear to me necessarily that what they truly want from this is to create that third party, because these are politicians. They know how tremendously difficult that would be. But if you say third party, if you talk about the dissolution of the current party, that's certain to get media attention. That's certain to get people talking about what you're talking about. And I think they're really just looking for any way to get people focused on their message of trying to restore moderate views, or at the very least, not be in total fealty to Trump within the Republican Party. The idea that they're going to do this from the outside by forming another party, that will fail. But I think their hope is that in the meantime, the messaging will get enough moderate Republicans activated that they'll be able to continue to fight from within the Republican Party.
And let's cast out several years ahead to the 2024 election. There's already been discussion that Liz Cheney might run for president herself. that she's playing a longer game. The Republican Party is becoming whiter, older, less educated, more male as it continues to embrace Trumpism. The GOP has lost suburban women at bigger numbers than they ever have before, and also women with college degrees. Most swing voters in recent focus groups saw removing Cheney from her leadership role as a big mistake for House Republicans. The majority of independents, by about 70%, believe that the 2020 election was decided fairly. So given those numbers, Sean, let's get you to maybe pull out your crystal ball as we look ahead to 2024. We could be in a very different place by then when we look at some of these dynamics. We'll have to see, but she could be thinking about 2024.
Certainly. I mean, if she wasn't thinking purposefully since the beginning of this about her future political career, possibly aspirations towards a candidacy for the presidency, she's definitely thinking about them now, because this is, you know, she comes out of this certainly as a symbol of resistance to Trump within the Republican Party, which would automatically make her one of the leading candidates of opposition if he were to choose to run in 2024, or if someone that was a clear Trump supporter, which there will be a series of them running in 2024 if Trump doesn't win, or doesn't run, she would be the clear person that would stand in opposition along with, you know, a couple other longstanding people that have been skeptical towards Trump, perhaps like John Kasich and other candidates like that. But the Republican Party right now, they're trying to solve a very difficult, maybe even impossible demographic and voting problem for their party that they've been seeing coming for a decade. We can go back to the loss of Mitt Romney in 2012, find afterward they immediately found a plan to try to boost support within the party from young people, from Latinos especially, from women. And, you know, it's just a few short years after that that Trump gained his political ascendancy and joined the party. And a lot of the plans that they had created, they had to sort of redraft in a different direction. So I think the fact that they're trying to replace Cheney with Elise Stefanik, as you mentioned, as the House conference chair, is an early version of them trying to solve this problem right now, as she is a somewhat more moderate and younger member of the GOP. So I think they're hoping that having her as a messaging person, it gives them somewhat more of an inroads to the growing demographics of the country, especially younger people. But at the same time, they're sort of stuck between two impossible things, which is that they're trying to get people, younger people, people of color, women, more into the party, through some of these things. But at the exact same time, the main reason why they're having a difficulty bringing them into the party is the deep unpopularity of Trump amongst those groups. So by trying to solve one problem, they're almost just making the other problem worse. And if they were to go in the opposite direction, if they were to try to go for someone that was more moderate, that was opposed to Trump in the short term, they would have devastating problems in terms of fundraising, messaging. So there's really not a solution, I don't think, to this problem. Whatever they do probably makes their long-term future more difficult. Now, that doesn't mean that 2022 and 2024 can't go well for them. Both elections could go fairly well. 2022 is a midterm, and typically when someone takes the White House, that party doesn't do very well in the next midterm. So, you know, for that reason, structurally, they would be expected to be favorites in 2022. They could perform quite well in 2024. But if we start looking to 2030, 2032, we start seeing a really, really difficult future for the Republican Party.
Let's go to your calls, 549-2937. Javon in Tampa, all the way from Tampa. Good morning.
Good morning. So the Republican Party does seem to have a real problem with the truth, whether it's the big lie, lying about climate change, lying about trying to sell JEA. But what does the average Republican actually do? The regular voter, the person who may be going to a party meeting, if they believe that Liz Cheney did the right thing, or they don't stand with Trump and those who are having this existential crisis with the truth, how do those people, I guess, help encourage the party to move in the right way if those kinds of Republicans still exist?
And you know what? Thank you, Javon. They do still exist. You know, when you look at the polling, Sean, about 30% of Republicans believe that the 2020 election was free and fair and that fomenting violence at the Capitol was wrong.
Yeah, this is a group within the party. They're now a minority within the party. As you said, about 30% is the right number on that. And this is a group that I think, to the caller's question, is pretty disillusioned, has been for months, if not years now, continue to be disillusioned. And the thing about disillusioned people is that they tend to take less action. There's a difference between being angry and fired up and being kind of hopeless and dejected. And I think one problem the Republican Party may face right now is that a lot of that 30% have already sort of felt like the war has been lost. And it's a difficult battle, to be sure, but that's not necessarily true. You know, if you're a Republican, then this is concerning to you. You find that Liz Cheney did the right thing. I would encourage, write your member of Congress, write the Republican Party, write your senator. Let them know that you feel this way because, you know, relatively speaking, these members don't get a lot of letters, phone calls on your average day. And the ones that they do get often tend to be more from those that are actively happy with what's been going on and they're part of the base. So, you know, one thing that the leadership could probably stand to hear is really from those 30%, not just on a poll, but directly, that they actually, you know, send their money to more moderate candidates, that they write letters to all of the Republican Party, letting them know that they stand with Liz Cheney. You know, if there's a high enough percentage of people that do that, I don't necessarily know that the leadership ends up flipping, reversing, and backing the Cheneys of the party, so to speak. But at the very least, they would feel a lot more nervous about taking open actions like this in the future. And, you know, that might create more of a position for moderates within the party to operate.
549-2937, Eric in Arlington. Hello, Eric. Go ahead.
Hey, 2 points, one general and one more specific. I think that Donald Trump represents the death rattle of the popular American narrative that white people, quote unquote, discovered America, white people built America. And really, when you look at it, what happened on January 6th was an objection to the fact that white people didn't win the vote. I mean, that's what that riot was about, was that people were angry because they lost. And so, and the more specific point is, if you look at, I think this is the Republicans circling the wagons with Liz Cheney, with the ouster of Lynn Cheney. If you look at all these issues, first of all, foreign policy, for the Republicans, it was China, not Russia. Right now, people are running around buying gas, okay, because the Russians, so they were wrong about that. Climate change, I don't even have to argue. I mean, enough said there. Gun rights. There have been almost 200 mass shootings since January 1st. And you can go on down the line, you know, election rights, civil rights. According to the Republican Party, Ron DeSantis included, there's nothing wrong with the way we police in America. So if you look at all these issues, it looks like they're wrong about everything, and they're anti-science. I mean, how could you basically build a party on all that? There's nothing they can do now but try to hide behind Trump. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Okay, Sean, let's talk about a few of his points. Certainly, President Trump told his supporters over and over again that ballots that were mainly cast in urban areas, these were ballots mainly cast by African Americans in a number of large cities where the vote in those states became close. He repeatedly said that votes were illegally cast, and they were not. He repeatedly tried to cast doubt on the validity of the certification process of those votes. More than 60 court challenges looking at these false assertions failed. And so what about the caller's point that the insurrection, it's perceived by him and others, was a resistance to the demographic changes in this country and an unwillingness to accept an increasingly multiracial democracy?
Over the past few years, since roughly 2016, since the Trump won election. There's been a small cottage industry in American politics research of trying to understand the Trump movement, understand where the Republican base has been going over the last several years. And, you know, the two competing explanations that have been sussed out by that research are sort of, you know, economic concerns, the concerns of the poor white working class watching, you know, factories close up and their jobs get exported. And then the second concern that, you know, sort of white replacement, racial animus. And, you know, a lot of these papers have pitted these two competing claims against each other. And sort of the overwhelming conclusion that the papers keep coming back to over and over again is that it's much more a story of racial animus and white concern with sort of loss of majority status within the country than it is economic concerns. And, you know, this is not just conjecture. This is looking at, you know, the real relationships between people's level of support for Trump within the Republican Party, their economic status, and, you know, what they say on racial issues, on a variety of questions, on surveys and otherwise. And time again, we find that there's a very strong relationship between support for Trump and concern about sort of white replacement, loss of white majority status. And this isn't just, you know, a vote for Republican is a vote for concern about these kinds of things. It's beyond that. I mean, McCain, Romney, they didn't have a very strong linkage with this sort of racial animus variable. But Trump, his relation to it has always been much stronger. The connection in his rhetoric has been much stronger to it. And so, you know, to generally get to what the caller was saying, you know, the Republican Party is sort of facing difficulty on a variety of issues where they've lined up against the scientific consensus or they've lined up against the voters on actual simple mechanical aspects of policy. The GOP has been most successful in the past several years where they've risen to sort of an abstract or symbolic kind of conversation. So rather than talking about, say, gun control at the level of policy, you talk about the general right to own firearms. Instead of talking about voting rights policies, you talk about the general concern of voter fraud. And so when people are asked about these symbolic positions, they're more likely to side with the Republican Party generally. When you dig down specific...
Sorry to cut you off. Let me just jump in.
Sure.
A listener asked us to point out that Trump did make gains with non-white voters in the 2020 election. So the data is complicated. Just wanted to add that context. Go ahead, Sean.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and that's very much worth pointing out that Trump gained, I think, 3% with African Americans relative to 2016. Some of these changes are just because of general increases in turnout across the board. Some of these changes, one reason why I think he gets this is simply the incumbency effect, which we can see in many presidencies in the past, that a lot of voters, or at least a significant enough percentage, will vote for someone that has been in office. Probably more complicated than that inside their own heads, but you automatically gain a few percentage points with a lot of different demographics for that reason. He may have done better with African Americans simply because of the incumbency effect, but it should be definitely thought about both within the Democratic and Republican parties that, observers in 2016 thought that Trump would lose for a variety of reasons, including the fact especially that he would do poorly with Latinos, that he would do poorly with people of color generally. And that really hasn't panned out in the way that people initially thought, despite the fact that there is this big link between support for Trump and racial animus. Your caller is absolutely correct as well, that this doesn't necessarily reflect the way that people of color have voted for Trump. And the GOP has not immediately lost support from either Latinos or people of color. And this was something that we saw especially in Florida, down in Miami, where Trump did particularly well with the Cuban delegation there. And that's a big part of the reason why he was able to win the state of Florida.
All right. Great to get your analysis. Hope you'll come back. Sean Frieder in the Political Science Department at UNF. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Shifting gears now. Hemp is increasingly being seen as having the potential to supercharge Florida's economy. Hemp producers in the Sunshine State do need financing, though, and there are special rules for this product. For more, I spoke with Stu Baker, Managing Director at Florida Capital Bank, Florida's Hemp Bank. Hi, Stu. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
This is a fascinating... Yeah, it's great to have you. So your bank, Florida Capital Bank, is known as Florida's Hemp Bank. This is interesting stuff because the hemp industry in Florida is really growing rapidly. Can you explain a little bit more about this sector of the economy and why we're seeing such rapid growth in Florida with the hemp product?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I got interested in it back in 2019, early after the 2018 Farm Bill was passed in Washington, which legalized hemp. And I was speaking with the folks in Tallahassee on the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. And they say, you really need to learn about this product because it's going to grow tremendously over the next few years. So I did, and I became educated and contacted a lot of people. And, you know, as it turns out, hemp has been around for thousands of years and has been used for many, many things. Our founding fathers used it. Two of the drafts of the Declaration of Independence were written on hemp paper, although the final was written on parchment. Mm-hmm. You know, Thomas Jefferson used hemp, and it's been something that's been used over time. And then in the early 20th century, it became illegal. So it was bundled in with marijuana. It has many, many uses, and I think we're only at this point at the very beginning of what's going to be a huge industry country, I believe.
Right. The Agriculture Commissioner, Nikki Fried, thinks this could be a $20 to $30 billion industry. So this is an important product for Florida. What are some of the uses that hemp's going to be turned to?
Well, hemp right now is being used primarily for oil, as you know, CBD. Mm-hmm. And that's where most of the activity is right now. There's also a burgeoning industry in hempcrete. There's a house in Tarpon Springs that was built entirely out of hempcrete. There's a couple of manufacturers. It's being used in textiles. There's a lady here in Jacksonville who manufactures towels out of hemp. It can be used in paint. It can be used to make wood. It can be used for hundreds of products. And the great thing about it is it's renewable and it's very ecologically friendly. And that's why it has such an upside.
Sure. It's fascinating to note that hemp was only approved for cultivation in the state a couple of years ago, and hundreds of Florida farmers are growing the crop all over the state. And this can be confusing for people because, as you said, Stu, people tended to conflate hemp and marijuana together, but they're not the same product. Can you explain that?
Well, actually, they come from the same plant.
Yeah.
So that's where a lot of the confusion comes from. It's called cannabis sativa. And the confusion comes in that hemp is defined as having less than 0.3% THC, which is the psychotic, in marijuana. So anything over that is illegal in the state. It's federally illegal, except for medical marijuana, which is legal in Florida. But the difference is that hemp has to be is very heavily regulated. Farmers have to be licensed. They have to provide details about their harvest. They have to measure the THC in their harvest. So it's not easy to do. But there are a lot of farmers in the state who are either devastated by hurricanes or who are being competing with out-of-country vegetable growers who are looking for new crops. And, of course, the orange groves are suffering from some diseases. And this has a great upside potential. I will say that it's a new industry. There needs to be more capital put into it. But I think the upside is tremendous.
And that's where you come in. You at Florida Capital Bank are now known as Florida's Hemp Bank. You are helping hemp producers get capitalized, get their products sold. And there are special rules for hemp and CBD businesses, and this can get complicated, these producers having access to financial services. So if you could, tell us about some of the hurdles and how Florida Capital Bank is working through them.
Sure. Well, we decided strategically to be in this business. So we have a team that is knowledgeable, experienced, and ready to help both growers, processors, manufacturers, and certainly retailers. It does require what we call enhanced due diligence, which means that we need to know a lot about the customer and what they're doing, who they are, because the federal regulators are also concerned about, they don't know a lot about hemp. They sort of bundle it with marijuana, and marijuana has always been an issue for them because it's a cash business and they're worried about money laundering. So with hemp, although it does allow regular banking to be used, they are requiring that we do what I said, enhanced due diligence. So we need to be a little bit invasive with each of these clients, and it takes a little bit of time on their part and some effort on their part to get everything we need. And that's true of any of the very few banks in the state who are dealing with this.
Mm-hmm. So this is, I would think, a niche space your bank has identified that's only going to grow, because many financial institutions probably aren't playing so heavily in this space. You see an opportunity.
We absolutely do. And it's interesting that you say that, because some of the larger banks are telling these folks, we can't bank you.
Yeah.
So we get calls every day from customers who being told by their institution, you've got 2 weeks to get your account changed. And it's just they haven't made the commitment and they don't want to get involved in it. So there's a big difference between us and some of these other, primarily the larger banks, but most of the smaller banks aren't educated either. So it's a very open industry for us. And we think, yes, it does have a lot of potential for the bank.
As I mentioned, the Agriculture Commissioner, by the way, she's also expected to run for governor. She came to office on a platform of promoting this product. Even if you're not a direct consumer of hemp or CBD or cannabis products, there's a business case, I think, to be made that these products can really be rocket fuel for Florida's economy. How do you see this sector impacting Florida's economic growth over the coming decade?
Well, I think in two ways. I think one would be the agricultural part, where the growers can have a crop that allows them to make some money. And the second thing are all the other things, which are the processors. And that requires a lot of capital, and there are about four or five in the state now. And then the manufacturers of things like hempcrete and textiles and things like that. We see a large interest right now in beverage manufacturers infusing their drinks with CBD. So that's another thing that's going to happen. And I think that as people learn about it and know that it is ecologically friendly, Secretary Freed has been a huge advocate, it will grow. But it's going to take a little time. I always say that because I think we don't want to get too over-involved or over-excited about it when it's a new industry and it needs to grow, and it needs to grow well. But it is going to happen.
So Florida has finalized what they call its hemp program and rules around that, so that farmers and businesses can grow this product and sell this product. If people are listening to this thinking, maybe I want to get into this world, they need to be aware there's a lot of regulation around it and some navigation of some complicated regulations. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. And we have a cannabis director in the state of Florida whose name is Holly Bell, and she works in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. So initially, if someone wants to go to the FDACS.gov website, they can learn a lot about what's going on with the hemp business. But always, they're very responsive with questions that people give them, and they're very happy to respond. And they have town halls and they have meetings, and so there's a lot of ability to learn about what goes on. It does require that individuals or farms or processors be registered with the state. So they also have a due diligence process that they follow.
And now that you're known as Florida's Hemp Bank, do you think the sky's the limit for this business? It sounds like, especially as we come out of the pandemic, you're pretty excited about it.
I am excited about it, and I have been ever since I started learning about it, because I think it is a product, a crop, a something that will transform certain industries. And if you look at hemp, I have T-shirts made out of hemp. I have hats made out of hemp. And so the sky's the limit in terms of what it can be used for. It can be used in paint. It can be used, in, as I said, to make wood. So it's just a question of the maturation of the industry. But it's, I'm very excited about the limits of it, and I, as I think the folks in Tallahassee are.
Well, thanks, Stu. Thanks for sharing your insights. He's Stu Baker, Managing Director, Banking at Florida Capital Bank, Florida's Hemp Bank. Thanks, Stu, so much.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, this month, May, is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Chris Powell, celebrity trainer and international fitness star of ABC's hit show Extreme Weight Loss, is in town this week, and he's going to be talking about mental health. His new nonprofit is called Move 1 Million. It's aimed at combating anxiety and also obesity. Chris Powell on the line now. Hey, Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. Good to talk to you. So during the pandemic, you've developed a lightning-fast workout routine inspired by something that's popular in Japan, right? This is a way to get, your mission is to get 1 million people moving. Tell us about this.
Yes, that's correct. So, you know, back in 1928, the Emperor of Japan mandated 3.5 minutes of movement across the entire country, from schools to corporations to everything. And sure enough, over the course of one generation, by 1955, he had raised their life expectancy by 40 years. It went from 40 to 45 years to 92 years. Japan became the healthiest country in the world. And they held that spot for six decades straight. And today, 27 million Japanese do this national routine of 3.5 minutes of movement every day. And it changed the culture. That he was able to weave movement into the culture of the people. And I saw that, especially about just, you know, I realized that, you know, a month and a half into the pandemic, and I just realized, okay, we're more sedentary than ever, and anxiety, depression, loneliness is going through the roof. We need to create something for these, for everybody. And so I created a 2.5 minute routine instead of a 3.5 minute routine, a 2.5 minute routine.
Because it's, we're Americans. We can't even do 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, right? and we need results fast. We need something really quick.
Exactly.
So we did 2.5 minutes, and it's a total body warm-up. And it activates in every single muscle group of the human body. It oxygenates the brain and the muscles. And it'll just make you feel really good, but at the same time, it gets us moving. And as they say, a body in motion remains in motion. So it's, I created it to be the very first step for everybody to take toward transformation, but for parents to move, for the kids to move. I mean, we serve everyone from 5 to 95, and so, but instead of, you know, in Japan, obviously they didn't have the technology that we have today. They used the radio. And today, it still plays at 6:30 every morning on the radio, but we have technology. And so, and I've been into app technology now for 4 years now. So I ended up building an app around it. I ended up building all this technology through a streaming web and through daily emails. And so everybody can receive this broadcast. So what we do is we start out the days with 2.5 minutes of movement. And then we do 2 minutes of mindfulness, which is all focused on breathing, centering ourselves. And then we finish it with positive affirmations. And the whole routine, the entire broadcast lasts about 4.5 to 5 minutes. And that's it. But it's movement and it's mindfulness together, because physical health, mental health, social health, it is a holistic approach to overall well-being, to putting us in a good mindset. And so, I ended up creating the whole thing. We launched five weeks ago.
And this is an app. This is an app called Move 1 Million. And so what you're asking people to do is download the app and then do the routine through the app. Yes?
That's it. It is an app you can download on the Google Play Store, on the Apple Store. It's 100% free. We are a free service to the world. And it's not just an app. You can also register your organization online or through the app, and you can receive the broadcast via a daily email. So we serve most of the schools in Arizona now. So we're actually just came out of the gates for serving 64,000 kids in the Mesa school districts. They do this after the Pledge of Allegiance every morning. And so they've registered their classrooms. And so each teacher gets a broadcast sent to their classroom, and then all the kids do it together to the projector.
How cool. Now, you started this, gosh, over a decade ago. You made a promise to yourself, right, that you were going to bring about positive change to at least 1 million people. Yes?
That is correct. Yeah, I've been through some crazy times in my life, and I'm definitely blessed with all the opportunities I've had recently. But I found myself living out of my car about 13 years ago. Mm. And I needed to turn myself around, and in order to do that, I needed a mission in life. And so I went to I was sleeping on a friend's couch in Los Angeles, and I woke up and I just thought, okay, I need a purpose in my life. And so I went down to the closest tattoo parlor, and I had him tattoo the Roman numerals 1 through 1 million down my side. And I
That's
told
a lot of numerals.
It's a lot of numerals.
Oh my goodness! We're getting a little tight on time, so I want to make sure that we also have time to explain how people can be part of your launch event this weekend in St. Johns County as you launch Move 1 Million in this area. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, so I'm going to be actually at a location called Shearwater. It's a healthy living community right there in St. Johns County. But due to COVID restrictions, it's going to be pretty tight down there. So we are streaming this live on my Facebook, which is at Real Chris Powell, or on the Shearwater Facebook page, which is it's Shearwater Life. So you go to Facebook.com, Shearwater Life, or on Real Chris Powell. And anyone can participate. It's at 10:30 a.m. Saturday morning. I'm going to be teaching the Move 1 Million routine to everybody in St. Johns County. My kids are going to be up there with me, so we're going to be going through that. Then we're going to do a super fun family workout. So anybody can tune in on our Facebook Live, and they can join in with us this Saturday at 10:30.
How fun. It's Move 1 Million. Check it out on Facebook at Real Chris Powell. Go to their website, m1m.org, or download the free app, Move 1 Million. As Chris, celebrity trainer and featured on ABC's Extreme Weight Loss, has created a 2.5-minute movement routine you can do every single day. Easy and healthy. So, Chris, thanks so much. This is great to talk about, too, during Mental Health Awareness Month, because we all will be calmer and happier if we're moving more. So, Chris, thanks.
Amen. Absolutely, Melissa. Thank you so much. And hopefully we'll see you out there.
Thanks so much, Chris. And in a moment, how you can score one-of-a-kind Jaguars merchandise, courtesy of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. We'll tell you about it right after this.
CNS Healthcare is offering an agitation associated with Alzheimer's dementia research study. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they shown verbal or physical symptoms of agitation? Learn more at 904-281-5757. Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
For 50 years, NPR has brought you perspective on the news, the big picture, the crucial context. Public radio is also a place for perspective you might not hear anywhere else.
50 years from now, when people are wondering what happened with the Minneapolis uprisings of 2020, they can literally come back to these boards and learn the entire history just from what's painted here.
Listen to NPR and hear every voice.
To support now, go to wjct.org/radio. And thank you. It took years for Linda Griffith to get a diagnosis for the severe pain that came with every menstrual cycle. It was endometriosis. She's a bioengineer who founded an MIT lab to investigate endometriosis. On the next Fresh Air, she'll tell us what her lab has learned about this disease and how it may lead to breakthroughs in treating other diseases. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Life expectancy on average has doubled since 1900.
Almost every major city has multiple monuments to lives lost in military conflicts. But you almost never see memorials to the lives saved thanks to medical or public health breakthroughs.
Shouldn't we make a bigger fuss over those who made it happen? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, in celebration of the NFL draft and the Jaguars' historic selection of the first overall pick, the team got together with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville to commission some one-of-a-kind painted and autographed footballs, commemorating all of the excitement. And these footballs are now up for auction. Diana Donovan is executive director at the Cultural Council, and she's on the line. Hey, Diana, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having us today.
Good to have you. These are 20 official NFL footballs painted by well-known local artists and autographed by Jaguars players. And people have until Friday to bid, yes?
Yes, ma'am. They are up and live, and you can do a buyout. So if you find one autographed football by a local artist that you really love, you can do a one-time price and beat the bid for $1,000.
Very nice. So people obviously want to see what they're bidding on. Where can they look at the images of these pigskins?
So we have www.culturalcouncil.org/artsandsports NFL football auction. So if they go to our website, they can just click on the link and it'll bring them directly to the NFL auction. And they'll be able to look through all of the footballs and all the beautiful works of art that five of our Northeast regional artists completed.
And some of the funds from the auction will go to the Cultural Council, which is great. You know, you don't often think of NFL football and the arts coming together. So this is an interesting collab.
Yes. So this actually was the launch of our Arts Plus campaign. So a commission goes directly back to the artists to honor them for their work and for their creativity and innovation. And then the rest goes to an innovation fund from the Cultural Council. And this helps us to be able to support other really exciting and future moving initiatives throughout the community.
You guys really are on a roll in a number of ways, because just today we've learned you've also received a $20,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. Tell us about that.
Yes. So one of the wonderful aspects of the Cultural Council is that we're a trusted steward of the city of Jacksonville. So we're already a re-granting agency. What we've been trying to do is really lean into that granting and re-granting arm and search for opportunities to receive funding on behalf of arts and culture organizations, entities, and individual artists. Because we believe that igniting the creative economy in Jacksonville will overall elevate the quality of life that we live here and share. And so grants like the NEA grant coming into us for the $20,000 is similar to how we had PNC give us $25,000 to be able to re-grant out, is, you know, being able to recruit money in using our skill set and using our, talent on our team to be able to help recruit funding for much needed areas of innovation within our community.
So, yeah, give me some examples of that, if you could.
Sure. So PNC is a great example. They came in to us and they said that they want to be able to give back to the artistic community and programming, and they were able to give us $25,000, and we were able to sit down, and as stewards, we go through the grant, we make sure that the grant giving is sustainable, that they're giving to programs that will be high impact, high quality, high caliber. And so if you go around like Riverside Arts Market, we have artists there who are doing live murals, you know, and that was a program that was able to be funded. And we're able to do grants out to figure out, you know, if somebody wants to create a program, Arts Plus Healing. The Arts Plus campaign is an open receptor, so we can partner with sports. And we wanted to start with the Arts Plus Sports campaign because it's something where you see two different entities that can be huge drivers in arts and culture. And we know that NFL football players have their own passions and heartstrings, as we saw with Trevor coming into Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really excited about what that looks like and how to meaningfully partner with people from either Arts Plus Healing, Arts Plus Medical, Arts Plus sports, Arts Plus Business, Arts Plus Banks, and be able to use that funding to help appropriate it back out and into our community for the people who are already being incredible innovators and creators.
So getting back to the auction now, people have until Friday to place their bids, Friday at noon, on 20 official NFL footballs. They were dipped in white paint to create a blank canvas, first of all, and then they were painted and decorated by well-known local artists and autographed by a Jaguars player. They are being auctioned off by the Jaguar Foundation until noon, Friday, May 14th. You can check out the footballs and place your bid if you go to culturalcouncil.org and look for the NFL football auction. By the way, Diana, how's the bidding going?
Going well. We had a couple footballs already off the market. People saw them and they loved them and they bought them. So we are excited and encouraged about the fact that we were able to extend the auction because there was so much interest in wanting to check out the footballs. So we very much say jump on it before we close because this is an incredible opportunity to support your local arts industry, your local arts artists, and the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Check it out, everyone, at culturalcouncil.org. Buy one for the football fan or the art lover in your life and support the arts in Jacksonville. Diana Donovan, Executive Director at the Cultural Council of Greater Jax. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. You're the best.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz. She likes art and football. So does director Josh Torres. Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo and Digital Editor Bill Bortsfield, also a big part of our team here. Along with you, keep your emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We value your feedback. And if you missed any part of today's show, our podcast is up later today. Wherever you listen, you can also listen through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our Friday Media Roundtable. Talk to you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.